needed to their specifications, instead of trying to adapt to a human-style forge. They needed special equipment, equipment they alone knew how to cast and forge. They were going to build us weapons, to fulfill their terms of service. Magic weapons. Master Suhi didn't like humanity in general, or me in particular, but he'd made his bargain and intended on keeping it. And he admitted to being intrigued about our strange folk. More, he was highly irritated at the people who'd kidnapped him, imprisoned his nephews, and, worst of all, to his eye, forced him to work against his will, without pay, or even a contract. After a few days being interrogated about his time in Olam Saheri, he quickly grew bored with the tiny forge at the small castle Taragwen. He was anxious to get to work, making real steel for us ignorant Humani. Steel that could be enchanted as easily as werewood, he insisted. Steel that could be used to fight Korbal. After discussing the matter with Master Asguri, who undertook the interrogation, and later formed a kind of comradeship with the Iron Folk Master, though they swore they hated each other, they came to me with a simple sketch and a list of requirements Suhi would need to achieve what he wanted. Though the sketch was simple, the design was grand. A foundry, a forge, a finishing room, and a list of tools 2 leaves long. I think Suhi made it more extravagant than it needed to be, just so that he could complain about poor conditions. But I merely handed the sheets back to the dwarves and shrugged. A week later, we were inspecting the site Pentandra had chosen for them, in the section Carmella had marked down on the plans for the Iron Folk. The small cottage, thanks to Carmella's foresight, met with their requirements. The Dradrian were snide about the accommodations, but they were clearly superior to a cell in Olam Saheri. Pentandra also put a score of former slaves who claimed some skill with the hammer and tongs at their disposal as a workforce. Master Komoran began working with them that very day, and showed them the pig iron ingots the foundry in Tudri managed to produce. The Dradrian were almost scandalized by it, but they pronounced the metal good, if the technique poor.
"This can work,"
Suhi decided, after Gareth, acting as Pentandra's castellan or assistant while she was still on maternity leave, completed the tour of the proposed facility by leading the Dradrian back to their cottage.
"The foundry will be the first to build,"
he said, in increasingly improving Narasi.
"We teach you Dradrian way of making steel," he promised. "Good steel, not brittle, not soft. Then we build forge. Right place for it,"
he grinned, pointing up toward the mountain in the middle of the vale. The anvil shape of the anvil seemed to be a good omen for the Dradrian. "What kind of magical weapons can you make?" I asked, curious. The problem was that we didn't have a common language of understanding to explain to each other what, exactly, we meant by terms like magical. Thankfully, Suhi understood the impediment as well, and stuck to the basics.
"Powerful,"
he assured me.
"Very powerful. Make you many weapons, if you can get the metals,"
he added craftily. "You tell me what you need, I'll get it," I agreed. "Master Komoran of Tudri is our weaponsmith. I would like for him to continue work with you, to teach you some of our words and techniques, and of course to learn from your vastly superior experience," I added. I had found out quickly that the best way to deal with the Dradrian was with a constant stream of flattery. It was annoying, and it disgusted the Karshak when I did it around them, but it worked. While the Iron Folk were settling their few possessions into the cottage, I walked with Gareth to Pentandra's croft, where she and Arborn were holding forth with the triplets. He seemed pretty cheerful, considering all that he was contending with at Vanador, but Gareth was good at that sort of management. He'd kept most of Sevendor Town running while Bannermore wasn't looking for years now. Running operations for a refugee camp was easy, or at least he made it look easy.
"It will be wonderful to get that project started," he said, with some sense of relief in his voice after we dropped Suhi back at his new home. "Half of my problems stem from so many idle hands. Every pair we put to work is a victory."
"Have there been any problems?" I asked, curious. The scrawny wizard shrugged his narrow shoulders.
"Not serious ones," he conceded. "The usual fights and such. Some don't want to work, if they think they'll be going south soon. We have a fair number of those. Gilmorans who want to get back home, if they have a home left. Most of the Wilderfolk are happy to pitch in anticipation of settling here."
I blinked.
They want to settle here. Gareth looked around. Since Nandine fell in the invasion, the Peel Towers and this settlement are about the only signs of stability and security in the north, save for a few remote strongholds like Osprey. Most of the Wilderfolk were taken from similar country on the other side of the river, so they're used to the terrain and the life. He slowed his pace notably as we rounded the bend in the rough road known as Wizard's Way, and I could hear him groan under his breath. "What's wrong?" I asked.
"Those three,"
he sighed, indicating a small cottage outside of which were three people impatiently waiting, two women and a man. "The Gilmorans I spoke of, who think they're too high-born to do common field work. I've had as many as a dozen outside my door each morning, but these three are relentless. We sent one caravan south already with the gravely ill and elderly, but it's only reached as far as Verone so far, and until we can get another contingent of guards headed that way, I won't authorize another, no matter how much they beg." He sighed, resigned. The three were a sorry-looking lot, but it was easy to see by their arrogant expressions that even a year or two as Gavanni slaves hadn't dimmed their enthusiasm for noble privilege. They looked desperate and determined, but not so much that they had started for Gilmora on their own.
"Could you speak to them, Minolin?"
he asked reluctantly. "I've been telling them the same thing every day for 2 weeks now, and I grow tired of repeating myself. A word from you might cool their heads." "I'll try," I agreed. That's something I was still getting used to as the spellmonger, all-powerful wizard and counselor to kings, dukes, and knights errant. Using my fame and prestige to get people to do what I wanted them to, just like I explained to my father.
"My Lord Gareth,"
began the oldest woman, the moment we were within conversational range,
"I know not what duties you attend to this morn, but I insist you spare me a few moments to discuss my case. I believe I have made it clear how urgent it was."
"Yes, Lady Imogen,"
Gareth said, steeling himself against the onslaught. "I am familiar with the dire state of your estates, the criminal manner in which you suspect they are being mismanaged in your absence, the importance of your swift return to set them aright, and the critical nature of the timing." He recited. "The timing?" I asked, confused.
"The Baron of Carenbol," she said haughtily, "has hosted the harvest ball at Cafindo for more than 100 years, and for the last 70 of those, House Barzan has been a prominent supporter and faithful vassal, as opposed to the treachery of House Leirgwyn, the most underhanded—"
"She wants to go to a ball,"
snorted the man derisively.
"Master Gareth, I assure you that I have over 7 estates that need my immediate attention in Dendrar. There's no telling what the goblins did in my absence, and I'm all but certain that my reeves were taken as well. If I don't return to begin repairing the damage soon, then there won't be a crop next year. I've already been gone for 2.5 years, he pleaded. "I need to get home."
"And you, my lady?" I asked the youngest woman, no more than 15 or 16. Blonde, scrawny with malnutrition and neglect, but still defiantly proud, even in a hempen slave's shift. "You wish to go home, too?"
"I am Lady Arcella of Maramore,"
she declared, firmly and confidently.
"I was betrayed by my servants and captured. I have no ball, nor grand estates to repair, but I fear I am the last of my line, and must tend to my family's estate in Lasara,"
she reported. I looked at each of them, and saw the sheer determination on their faces. The kind of determination that allowed them to survive the ordeal of captivity and slavery, beatings, and near starvation. Despite their misguided and misplaced priorities, they were still eager to return to the lives they once knew. That, unfortunately, was impossible for them. "Gentlefolk, I am Baron Minolin of Sevendor, called the Spellmonger," I introduced myself. "I am a friend of Master Gareth here, and he has been telling me the great work he has done in attempting to sort, organize and support the 30,000 other former slaves in that camp," I said, cocking my head toward the tent city. "To be candid, compared to the refugee camps around Verone, you gentles should count yourself fortunate. But Master Gareth has limited resources, and is constrained by larger events," I continued a little more firmly. "He cannot change the situation in the world at large, unfortunately. The roads between Vanador and Verone are fraught with danger at the moment. Bands of goblins and hobgoblins are scouring the vales for their lost slaves, and setting upon anyone who can't defend themselves. That means that the only caravans headed south must be guarded heavily, else we send them to their doom. It was a reasonable explanation of the delay on their departure, but they were unconvinced.
Your Excellency, the man said, I am Lord Joam of Kinsey, and I have been waiting here daily to secure the quickest transport south. Cost is no object. If you can arrange...
I doubt I can arrange anything, wizard or not, I said apologetically, but perhaps I can ease your minds in regard to the urgency of your return to Gilmora. Firstly, my Lady Imogen, I regret to inform you that the Baron of Carindor was slain with all of his kin when Carindor was sacked. It's likely the harvest ball will therefore be rescheduled indefinitely. Indeed, the new Baron of that country is no less than Duke Anguin himself, I added.
As he is also the new Baron of Losara, my Lady Arcella, I suggest you both petition his grace for advice and assistance, as he is your new liege. As far as Dendra goes, it was heavily damaged in the invasion. Most of its people were taken captive, and though the main Gavanni forces were driven from it, the forests and swamps of the region are infested with goblin irregulars who harass and kidnap yet more slaves they encounter. There is precious little of Dendra left standing, I informed him sorrowfully.
But Dendra City had thousands of people in it, Lord Joam insisted.
They can't all just be
gone.
Those who weren't taken have largely fled, I countered. They are in refugee camps near Barrowbell themselves, or have taken work on estates in the south. The Baron of Dendra himself has taken refuge in Almiranda, because Castle Dendra is uninhabitable now. Indeed, most of Gilmora north of the Poros is. I watched their faces fall as I confirmed what Gareth had evidently already told them. There really isn't much point in trying to return until security is established. Otherwise you'll end up in chains again, I cautioned. There was a brief silence as my words sunk in. Then the youngest of them burst out impatiently.
Well, if we cannot go home, can we at least get closer to it? Verone is a city of some size, from what I understand. Can we not get at least that far? She begged.
As soon as the roads are clear, my lady, Gareth assured.
Well, that's hardly...
She began to retort. Lord Gareth is doing the very best that he can under the circumstances, and appreciates your patience, I said sternly. I assure you, the best course of action for you to consider now is to be nice to him, I demanded. He is doing what he can, with the resources he has under trying circumstances. You three and your peers claim to be nobles. Start acting like it, I lectured. Those people down there are bereft of leadership right now. They look to their nobles for guidance and calm, and you three are up here like tenants in arrears on the rent, banging on Lord Gareth's door. That made them look ashamed, but no less determined. Lord Joam spoke for them all.
My apologies, my lords.
He sighed heavily. When one is bereft of family and friends, one seeks to return to them at the soonest moment, he explained unnecessarily. As long as it is certain that we are among the first to depart south, I have no doubt that he wishes that as well, I said dryly. But a little more patience will purchase more than a little more persistence. That seemed to mollify them, although from the look on the youngest one's face, she'd be back later to convince Gareth of her earnestness in private. Of course, the lad had no idea what might be in store. Gareth's innocence is one of the things I like about him.
Thank you,
he said sincerely as they headed slowly back to camp.
Every day it's the same thing. When is the next caravan for Verone departing? What do I need to do to be on it?
Every day it's the same answer, but yet they return. If that's the worst you must contend with, you're doing well, I chuckled quietly. Pentandra had actual riots when she first came to Verone.
Oh, I know, he sighed. Things could be much worse, and it feels good helping people like this, despite the complaints, he added.
Most of these folk have been so poorly treated that they barely feel human. Plenty of them still can't seem to grasp that they are free of the Gavanni now. The idea that they can start their shattered lives anew unsettles them. The nobles are bad enough. But when you find some widow searching in vain for her children, or a husband for his wife, or a child for their parents, it's hard.
It will be much harder for all of them, I observed. Those determined enough to return to Gilmora will find little but ruin left of their old lives, and the wilder folk are completely dispossessed.
They will have to settle here. I looked around before we mounted the steps to Pentandra's Croft. The anvil really was a pretty place, no matter where you looked. I could see why Pentandra was in favor of building this city, even if its folk were destitute former slaves. There was potential here, I saw. Potential only a desperate people hungry for a home could realize. The labor was certainly available. The fields to the west of the town were nearly cleared of rocks and brush. Garrus said that the silt would be delivered within days. Every shipment of lumber from the nearby timber yard was quickly consumed building more housing, and men who had labored under the lash for years freely bent their backs to help their fellows raise the rickety shacks they would soon call home. Potential, I agreed. But it still had long to go.
So, the Forsaken are us,
Pentandra proposed, as she rocked in a swing chair in front of her croft, a baby on her breast while her mother held another. I wasn't certain where the third was, but I didn't ask.
Our ancestors, at any rate.
Comrades of our ancestors, I corrected. They were people who didn't get off the ship.
I know.
Pentandra said, shaking her head.
Just thinking about a ship 3 miles long makes my head hurt. A flying ship.
It does help answer some questions, I agreed, particularly about the Order of the Secret Tower's obsession over them all these years.
I still don't know if they were formed to protect us from them or to reclaim them, she said wearily.
Feeding 3 babies was exhausting, and her face looked pale and deprived of sleep.
But if they were the inner council of the Archmage, and the Magi usurped power from the original authorities and exiled them...
Maybe both, I agreed, finishing her sentence. They must have felt secure enough in the colony to risk it, but it must also have been terrifying, sending the basis of their civilization away.
I can't help but feeling deceived by the Alka-Alon, she said. We've been struggling to figure out who the Forsaken were for centuries. And they could have come along and saved us all of that by just telling us.
But it still doesn't tell us if the Forsaken are to be feared
or welcomed.
I think the point is moot, I sighed, sadly. From what Harathel said in council, whatever they did to send the ship into exile was permanent. The invocations to return it to our skies are long lost.
Nothing is long lost,
Pentandra said with unexpected hopefulness.
There are 40,000 people on that ship who think they're on their way to a new world. They'll be stuck there for all of eternity if we don't do something.
Pentandra, what can we do? I asked, spreading my hands wide. All of that was lost in the inundation.
Not all of it, she replied stubbornly. The Order of the Secret Tower kept records, specifically about the Forsaken. If they were afraid of them, perhaps some of the unintelligible records say why. But they didn't have the context to interpret them. If they wanted to recall them, perhaps that's where we need to start.
I suppose I should devote some time to the research, I admitted. I've just been busy. She glared at me.
You don't know, busy. I have 3 of these monsters sucking on me now, she said accusingly. 3! The moment I finish one, the next is ready to go. I have 2 wet nurses to help, but they devour everything that comes near them. I'm finally able to walk a little. But if I take more than 10 steps away from my door, they start wailing for more milk.
I'll take a look at the records, I promised. I'll make the time.
Your old Hypermanese is awful, she accused. Your vocabulary is basic at best, and you have not context for comprehension on many of these things.
My hair is messy today, too, I added. So, if you don't have the time...
Then you certainly don't, because you're supposed to be busier than I am, she snapped.
We'll hire some clerks, she decided.
Verone has a few who could work on it, and I'm sure there are plenty of others. But if there is any way to free the Forsaken, we need to look into it.
But why? I asked. If our ancestors were so afraid of them, then why shouldn't they spend eternity in stasis? I can't think that they'd be happy to learn of their fate if they did get out.
That was centuries ago, she dismissed. No one involved is alive now, with the exception of a couple of Alka-Alon.
Any lingering animosities over the matter are moot, she countered.
They're human beings. We're human beings. We have an obligation to at least look into it. Besides, from what I understand,
Our ancestors were not the puny weaklings we make them out to be pre-magic. They were a sophisticated, thorough, highly reasonable civilization. I'm certain if they're at all like us, they would be open to a reasonable discussion. Perhaps. I nodded. I guess it depends upon the specifics of the situation. But, yes, they might be reasonable. Or they could rain fire and death down on us from their skyship, like Dara does with her hawks. The Order feared them because they had the power of dissolution, I reminded her. Whatever that might mean.
There's that, Pentandra conceded, biting her lip. Don't you think of the cheeriest things?
Too much war magic, not enough sex magic, I joked. When we get a chance, we should probably gather a council to study the matter, I proposed. Someone to steer the clerk's efforts.
Your father, perhaps?
That caught her mother's attention.
He would really be the best one,
Pentandra agreed. He's as familiar as anyone with the ancient texts, and he's intelligent enough to appreciate the delicacy of the matter. Perhaps if we gave him a few select experts, he might uncover something. It would at least be a place to start.
I will also make certain he and the other scholars are granted access to the Hall of Memories at Carnaduin, I decided. They have some relics and records from those days. Remember that map they had? And that's where they kept Lelastian's Humani equipment.
I would dearly love to get away for a few weeks and indulge in pure research like that, she said dreamily. But something tells me I won't have time for that sort of thing until these monsters reach puberty or beyond. As it is, Anguin has me preparing for and participating in the new Alshari Moot, she said.
That's an old Wilderlands term for council, she explained. The Ducal Court is going to address the reorganization of the Wilderlands now that the lines have more or less settled. The old order just doesn't apply anymore, and Count Angriel wants a general council on reforming the government to fit the new reality, especially before the Royal Curia.
That's uncommonly wise of him, I nodded. Most feudal governments cleave to tradition like it was wine, unwilling to abandon the remnants of any old titles or offices.
Anguin's regime, beset by problems and forced to compromise in many ways, was actually doing something reasonable.
Believe it or not, the political force really pushing for it is Radin, she confided. She was up here with Anguin last week, inspecting the camps. We had a nice chat about it. She's actually not so awful when she's not thinking of ways to kill you.
Radin wants to reorganize the Wilderlands, I asked suspiciously.
She's become an advisor of Anguin's,
Pentandra nodded, as she handed off one daughter to her mother and accepted another.
Quite a canny one, too. When Rad asked Anguin for his choice of any of the four baronies vacant in Alsha, she advised him to choose Osara and Carinbol, even though they were among the most ravaged by the invasion. He already has lands and estates in the region, and selecting those two baronies allows him contiguous control over most of his Alshari lands now. Right through the center of Gilmora, she added with a slight smile.
And how did the Crown take that?
They were unhappy, but incapable of doing anything about it. Radin delivered the message, and she was insistent on Anguin's rights. She took advantage of Tavard's absence and persuaded Count Kindine to acquiesce. She wouldn't leave the palace without the deeds and parchments. I think they gave it to her just to get rid of her.
She's a strategic thinker, I praised.
Those two baronies give Anguin a big slice of territory right in the middle of Gilmora. Tavard isn't going to like that at all.
Well, if he ever returns from Maiden's Pool, he can voice his opposition, she chuckled. But it was his wife who signed off on it. Not that Rad gave her any choice. It appears that Radin still has some influence over her father, even if her mother is distant.
From what I understand, he might actually have some of the nobility of those lands here, I informed her, and told her about the three hapless nobles outside of Gareth's door. Getting them returned to their estates, however empty, may encourage some of the peasants to return.
Well, that's another problem, Pentandra said, adeptly switching boobs. A goodly portion of the slaves were Gilmoran villeins or even serfs.
Under Castali law, they are still considered bonded even if they have been away from their estates without leave.
Being enslaved should buy them an exemption, I noted wryly.
One would think, Pentandra agreed. The thing is,
Al-Shari law states that a villein who can subsist in a chartered town for a year and a day can apply for freedmen's papers. City air is free air, I said, quoting a popular proverb, among the villeins, less so among the gentry. But the closest town is Tudri, if its charter still stands. Beyond that is Verone. And aren't the capital cities exempt?
Yes, they are,
Pentandra agreed, but you are mistaken. I took the liberty of drawing up a charter for Vanador, and Duke Anguin is kind enough to sign and seal it. It has specific provisions covering the status of escaped slaves, she said smugly. But Vanador is a... well, it's a glorified village, I pointed out, confused. There aren't 20 cottages and crofts out there, unless you count the warehouse, I said, speaking of the lone storage building assembled under the overhang. How does that constitute a town?
Because I say it does, and I'm the Lady Mayor, at the moment.
On parchment, between feedings, and court functions, she groaned. But next year, about 10,000 of those folks will be able to return to Gilmora with their freedman documents, which means they will have to be paid wages. And pay a much higher rent, I pointed out. One of the few advantages that serfs and villeins had in Gilmora was the fact that their housing was largely paid for by the estates they were bonded to.
Rent on what? Those fiefs are depopulated. There are plenty of houses there. But I don't want these people to have been rescued from one kind of bondage, only to be forced into another. They deserve better than that. If we can grant them their freedom, and maybe even a little coin and some trade experience up here in the next year, then when they do return to Gilmora, they will have a much better bargaining position.
I suppose it will take Anguin that long to organize those lands anyway, which is why Radin negotiated a 5-year suspension of tribute to the duchy for each barony, and coaxed another 1,000 roses out of her daddy to spend on restoration and repatriation apiece. Something else Tavard is not going to be happy about, she warned.
Tavard's happiness is becoming less and less of an issue for me, I grumbled. If he couldn't hang on to those baronies of his own accord, then it's best for Anguin to have them. And I take it the Al-Shari court is pleased.
It's the largest Al-Shari gain in Gilmora in 50 years. Of course they're pleased, Pentandra agreed. In fact, several of them want to invest in the new lands. Cotton brings a far higher price at market than timber, and it's easier to move than iron, by traditional means, she added smugly. Now that Anguin has started spending some of the treasury's coin, some of the nobles want to invest. Yet another reason why we need to reorganize the Wilderlands, she groaned, then winced.
Fentra, you are all done,
she insisted to her daughter, before throwing her over her shoulder and patting her back. The little mageling didn't cry. She just looked confused with her new eyes until she belched. Then she smiled.
With all that reorganization and new responsibilities, it's a wonder you can handle your new duties as Lady Mayor of Vanador.
Administration is 9 hells easier than lactation, she complained. Here, you change her. I'm done, she said wearily, handing me her stinky baby.
Chapter 59 Drinks with Friends. I got to enjoy the rare entertainment of watching Pentandra's mother and her maid attempt to cook Ramiran delicacies in a primitive Kasari iron kettle for us, after Arborn returned from a day inspecting the defences near the river. It was a merry evening in the cosy little croft. With the right spells, it was well ventilated and cool in the summer night, with mage lights floating inside and out. I played with babies until they couldn't be tickled anymore, and their grandmother insisted they go to bed. Pentandra had a special 3-sectioned cradle that not only rocked itself magically, but had an enchantment that dampened sound from waking the babes. After dinner, while Penny took a much-needed nap, Arborn and I retired to the little garden directly outside of the croft door. A couple of pipes and a bottle of wine, and it was a delightful way to watch the stars and talk about the war.
"Things are stirring in the penumbra,"
he reported, after we got to that comfortable point in the evening where candor is more important than wit.
"Do tell," I invited him. "My scouts are reporting a lot of activity around the outer cantonments. Astaroth's agents have brought him word that the Goblin King is bridling at the idea of following the Enshadowed now,
much less the Nemovort, Korbal installed as his regent in the Dark Vale of the Umbra. Another pretends to be Korbal's ambassador to the king, and stirs much resentment in his shaggy court. The talk in the penumbra is of war, though if it is against us or each other, I do not know, he confessed. Is there no reaction to the theft of their slaves? I asked, surprised. That was the initial point of the contention between the two parties, I think, Arborn suggested. The Goblin King wanted to give chase and recover their property, as well as deal with their vengeance against us. They blamed the Nemovorti and the Enshadowed for allowing it to happen, and then again when they insisted that he stay his forces for some greater purpose. That's disturbing to hear, but encouraging to hear dissension in the enemy's camp. What happens when the Goblin King prevails and sends a legion against you? They would have to cross the fords of the rivers, each of which is now being watched, he assured me. We have a plan to fall upon them mid-crossing. The Third Commando have small companies of cavalry, riding with a few Wilderlords between here and the Mare River, on the east bank. There are larger garrisons at Baylor's Tower and Ragnar's Tower to slow them down further. And then there are 300 commandos, 200 Wilderlords, and near 1,000 men-at-arms encamped at the entrance to this plateau. What about the slaves? Can they defend themselves? Sir Maegon is in charge of camp security. He nodded. He's been recruiting men with the experience and inclination to fight, and doing some elementary training with spears and shields. But it's slow going. Most of these people showed up here half-starved and near death after the flight across country. Now they build their strength on wholesome food and moving rocks. Hopefully by autumn they will be strong enough to plow and plant, and fight, if there's a need. I nodded, thinking about the matter as I let the sweet smoke trickle through my lips. The struggle over priorities is telling, I observed. If Korbal is now in sole command, and he desires the Gavanni gather their strength on his behalf, but not to pursue their slaves, that suggests another target. Varone? He asked, troubled. He'd spent a lot of time protecting Varone. Mayhap, I said, but I fear a grander target. Korbal isn't like Sherul. He's emotional. He has an ego. Vanity. He'll pick a target to make an example of. He wants to conquer humanity, not just exterminate us. And after our raid and the prisoners we took and rescued, he's going to sting. He'll want to humiliate us. There are military targets he might consider first, Arborn proposed. Tudri has been a thorn in his side, as has Fort Defiance, and the Umbra itself brushes Count Markadine's seat. Attacking any of those would give the enemy advantage. But it would not suit his grand strategy, I think. He is no goblin. Lucky for you, I don't think either Varone or Vanador. Vanador is a tempting enough target. I hope you're right, Minolin, he sighed. Since the girls came along, I find myself suddenly fearful of such things in ways I never considered before. That, my friend, is the curse of fatherhood, I advised. Parenthood, actually, for the affliction strikes new mothers just as profoundly, though in different manner. Let me guess. You're suddenly looking behind every bush for bandits and wondering if the cat has the pox. I was considering building a fortress, he admitted guiltily. That seems a bit excessive, I suppose. You're speaking to a man who's turning a mountain into a castle, because a regular castle isn't strong enough to protect my children, I reminded him. I can empathize. I am well versed in the arts of paranoia. A gift of the Aronin, I suppose, I said sarcastically. You're going to need a fortress here. I believe that was the entire purpose for choosing the site to begin with, wasn't it? To build a city to attract the fury of Sherul? Much has changed since then, and there is more than one reason for such a castle. The west bank of the Mare is dangerous. With Nandine destroyed, there is no town of note in the north anymore. The site is ideal for such a place. Easy to defend, arable land, and some industry. More, now that you've brought the Dradrian. How long will you stay here? I asked. Long enough to see these folk settled for winter, before we return to Varone. Pentandra has been granted a leave of absence, until the Royal Curia, at Yule. We intend to enjoy it, he said simply. Ulam Sehari was difficult for both of us. In truth,
There were several times I thought I would never see my daughters born that day. It was harrowing for us all, I agreed, but a tale for the ages. Let's hope that the next time we go back there, it's to wipe it clean and rebuild Lost and Thatiel. We drifted off into silence as we smoked and stared at the stars. They seemed much clearer at this elevation. I could not help but wonder which among them was concealing the mighty ship that brought us to this world. I thought of the 40,000 forsaken souls locked within that ship, hopeful of a new life on a new world someday, but condemned to drift in eternal darkness. It was a sobering thought. I had no explicit duty to the Forsaken, outside of common humanity. Well, I was assuming it was common, but something in my heart moved me to consider their fate. I could see no real way I could effect their rescue. I was no celestial mother to guide the stars in their courses. Of course, I did have access to the next best thing, I reminded myself. I had no idea how I could or would do such a thing, but that's never stopped me before. But on further reflection, as much as delving into such a fascinating historical riddle held much intellectual appeal, it just couldn't be a priority. There was a war on, one that was heating up, because of my raid. That had to be my first priority now that Alia was healing. It's pretty up here, I said finally, like Bovol Vale before the invasion. I like it. I've always been partial to the Eastlands, Arborn affirmed as he packed his travel pipe. I've known it since I was a boy. The Kasari have camped and hunted this territory for hundreds of years. Since before the Narassi came, we have hidden refuges and camps all over here. Good fishing, too, he added. Have you had any issues with your Narassi vassals? From Otter's Point? Nay, he said, shaking his head. The old lord was the last who saw the Kasari in an ill light. The few hamlets betwixt there and here don't even know I'm their lawful lord now. He chuckled. I visit them from time to time, just to see how they fare. I suppose they'll figure it out eventually. How are the Kasari taking your new rise in position among the Narassi? They see it as a fulfillment of our duty to be helpful, he said diplomatically, after a moment's thought. Anguin's use, and prompt payment for the services of the rangers he's hired, has helped build some trust. But a few still see me as betraying the spirit of the Kasari, if not the law, by taking service with the duchy. Now is not the time to nurse old feuds, he pronounced. No, it is not, I agreed. Well, I wish you luck. What you and Pentandra are doing here is much like what I tried to do with Sevendor, mixing different peoples together, trying to maintain security and order, and developing a town from scratch through magic and an obscene amount of gold. Of course, if I can do it, you two won't have any problems, I dismissed. That earned me a look. You do realize that we're doing this with very little resources, scant support, on the edge of a war zone, he pointed out. Well, yes, I agreed reluctantly. But you're starting from scratch, I emphasized. You didn't have to start out correcting someone else's mistakes and neglect, and you have me to help you. I didn't have that. You have an intriguing and unusual perspective on things sometimes, Menelan, he reflected, after smoking for a moment. I'm a wizard, I shrugged. Thinking up elaborate rationalizations is my bread and butter. On the way back to Sevendor, I took the opportunity to stop by Verone, at Turleman's invitation. Actually, I was getting ready to take the ways back to Sevendor, when Turleman burst into my mind as loud as anyone but Sherul ever had. Min, you have got to drop what you're doing and get to Verone and see what this girl is doing, he insisted, before I could get a word in. She's got this vase, and... Wait, 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 my friend, I said, trying to calm him down. Turleman is an old soldier with an old soldier's capacities, but he was clearly drunk. Where are you? Exactly. Verone. He repeated, streets of flowers. I love this place. Winnick and I brought a bunch of the boys along to spend some of our pay, and we got distracted. Just when did you arrive? Huh? 9 days ago, he said, after struggling with the number. Don't worry, we haven't spent the entire time drunk, but old friends kept dropping by to congratulate us,
And so we kind of lingered. Sandoval showed up with his new girlfriend. Astral was here a few days, went back to Tudri, and then came back, and he brought Rostello. You remember Landrick? Landrick was here, just met him in the street. We've been drinking this Pearwoods stuff for hours now, but you really should join us. He pleaded, we've been talking about the raid and how things stand at... Well, your name has come up. We've all wished you were here. I didn't want to disturb you, but then this dancer came out with a vase, and I thought, you know, men would love to see this.
I sighed. I didn't much feel like socializing after the pleasant evening with Pentandra's new family, but then I had a responsibility to support my men even when they weren't on the battlefield. Astaral, Sandy, Turleman, Wenick, and those guys didn't feel rewarded by speeches and estates at this point. They fought because it was what they were good at, and they fought for me because I was their friend, as much as I was their commander. A night drinking and carousing in Verone's increasingly popular Red Mage-like district with them would mean more for our relationship than riches or flattery. Those relationships required as much maintenance as any, despite the camaraderie of war. A wizard who didn't have good friends to call upon to, say, assault the secluded fortress of an evil Dark Lord had only himself to blame. Fine, I admitted finally. It was already too late in Sevendor to see the children tonight. My sister would have already tucked them in. No one was expecting me anywhere tomorrow. I'll be there shortly, I finally agreed. Just a few drinks, I warned. I still have important spellmonger stuff to do.
Like what?
He asked with drunken curiosity. Like building my new war staff, I said, grasping for something Turleman would appreciate.
You can do that later, he said, but if you don't hurry up, you're going to miss what she... Is she's tits? How does she get it all?
Alas, by the time I brought myself through the ways to Turleman Stone, just outside of the tavern, the show was over, though Turl didn't have any problem explaining the technical and dramatic elements of the piece, occasionally using hand gestures to symbolize positioning. I didn't even get to hear how it turned out, though, because the rest of the party was moving from the tavern-slash-brothel complex to a much statelier tavern up the street, where it was rumored a minstrel of rare wit and a squadron of youthful dancers was performing. The moment they came out the door, I was swarmed and embraced by sweaty, drunken war magi. I greeted them all eagerly, and we started down the street in a tangled mob. Wenick's arm was still in a sling, a result of the last duel he'd had with an Emmervort, while others were rescuing us, and Turleman was still bandaged in at least three places, but it appeared all were healing. Sandoval's new girlfriend proved to be the woman he rescued from the necromancer's dungeons. Andra Anna Corsine looked much better than the last time I'd seen her. She was wearing a new gown of local style, a lovely dark green with light green trim. She seemed to hover closely to Sandy, I noted. Indeed, she never got more than arm's reach from him all night. He seemed to share the attachment, I also noted. Whether there was some previous spark there that had rekindled, or if his rescue of her from certain death and post-mortem insult had driven them together, but he acted very protective of her all evening. Andra was a very pleasant woman, I discovered, the descendant from an old imperial house in southern Alshar. She was a practical adept, but one who focused on thaumaturgy and spell design theory. Not a great way to earn a living, to my mind, but she'd done well enough before she was kidnapped. The tavern we lit at for the next few hours was a relatively new one known as the Daffled Dragon, and bore a sign with a cartoonish geriatric dragon with a beard, clearly in his cups. It proved a merry place with wide windows, tables outdoors, a trio of musicians, fiddle, tambour, and cittern, and five busy barmaids to serve. I ordered several bottles of wine for the table, paying a rose in advance. I honestly didn't have anything smaller on me, and ensuring incredible service all night. Once I complained about the lighting, and threw six mage lights into the air around the tavern, I became the barman's new favourite customer. The discussion was loud and boisterous as we complimented each other about various elements of the recent raid, particularly my inspired use of the handmaiden to fuse Corbald to his body. I was pretty thick with the praise myself, picking out particular instances of impressive performance among my comrades.
You missed all the really exciting stuff while you were down in that hole,
Telemann taunted me, trying hard not to slur his words.
We were throwing spells we wouldn't have dared throw on a human battlefield. I killed hundreds of hobgoblins, personally,
he bragged.
Damn near blew out my war staff. Exhausted every spell on my blade,
he added proudly, but Duin himself couldn't have thrown a better battle, he said encouragingly.
Oh, I tried the new anti-personnel spell you missed,
Wenik said excitedly as he could with one arm.
I call it Wenik's Calentia,
he declared, pronouncing the words with great deliberation.
Pure red magic. Rael gave me the idea. It's a cast sigil that targets the enemy's hypothalamus. In 60 seconds, the target is running a high fever, high enough to cause them to pass out. Sometimes they die from shock, the weak ones, anyway.
Used it twice. It was glorious, he smirked, his fat face smiling. Before the conversation could descend into pure shop talk, a real danger considering the amount of wine involved, I quizzed Telemann about the others from the raid and their whereabouts. There were a few funerals for prominent dead approaching, including one of Count Markadine's popular bannermen, who'd volunteered.
All in all, the Wilderlords have been pleased with how it went, though they bore the bulk of the casualties. Those who survived are describing it as the biggest battle of their lives, against the most evil force on Kalidor.
I'm considering commissioning a ballad, he admitted. Unlike Azar, Telemann tended to be fairly humble about his abilities when it came to professional aggrandizement.
It does seem like the first successful offensive strike of the war, Wenik agreed. That alone makes it noteworthy.
Well, while you heroes were away in the Mindens, some of us stayed behind and kept the Garvani at bay,
Rustalo, who'd managed to grow an impressive beard in the last few years, said defiantly.
We had incursions all over for a week or so after the Great Escape. Thankfully, they skipped the villages for once and went straight after the military outposts.
Carmela told me that two of the Peel Towers were besieged briefly,
agreed Sandoval.
For all the good it did them,
Landrick said, smiling.
I was at Traveller's Tower when we were hit with a company of goblins and fell hounds. They tried to use a battering ram to take the door until I turned it into splinters. Then someone used a sonic spell to chase the doggies away, and it was just target practice after that.
The former censor grinned.
The worst incursion was at Lorvay,
Telemann reported. About 600 goblin infantry tried to cross the ford in pursuit of the southern group of escapees. They got pegged at the ford by archers and charged by Wilderlord cavalry as soon as they crossed. A company of commandos swept in from behind and slaughtered every furry one of them.
Good mercs, those commandos, Wenik nodded approvingly. Tough as boot leather.
Glad Anguin got them. Had them training my lads back in the Pear Woods. Cavalry, infantry, archers, sappers, whatever you need them to do, they know how.
Good, we'll need them, Sandoval predicted, putting his arm around Andra. They're going to have to hit us back for that. I'm guessing Tudri.
Varone, Wenik said instantly. They'll hit Varone.
I think they'll go further south, Landrick proposed. Preshar Castle, Markadine's seat. The Umbra is only 6 miles away from it now. They've already taken a lesser fortress, nearer at hand. Preshar is the largest defense between the Umbra and the Five Rivers.
Markadine will destroy it rather than see it captured,
Telemann said, shaking his head.
We are in agreement that a fortress that large, that close to Tudri and Varone, cannot be allowed to be held against us.
I think you're being very short-sighted in considering Korbar's response,
Andra said, speaking for the first time.
During my time in the dungeons, I overheard many snippets of many plans the necromancer has for us, and I can assure you, gentlemen, that they are far more majestic and multifaceted than besieging a rural castle, or even sacking a provincial capital,
she said apologetically.
They mean not to strike at any particular place, but at many places at once. They think not in terms of castles and armies, but in cities and infiltrations.
You don't think Korbal will use the goblins?
Telemann asked, skeptically.
Of course he will. But they are merely his soldiery, now, to keep the Enshadowed from being occupied by petty duty. The Nemavorti despise the Gavani. They see them as nearly animals.
They prefer hobgoblins largely because they find them less annoying and more purposeful. His real power is in his disciples.
The Enshadowed,
supplied Telamon, and the Nemovorti. They, most of all. The Enshadowed are his officers, but the Nemovorti are both general staff and secret weapons. Some are fearsome fighters. Others are canny adepts. Still others are fanatical and obsessive about their cause. They are who you should be fearing, not the Gavani.
How do you think they might infiltrate us, Melody? Rostello asked, curious.
Apart from me, he was likely the least drunk among us. They delight in exploiting humanity's own weaknesses against us, she considered, cocking her head prettily.
Her face looked thin and pale, thanks to her long imprisonment underground and poor diet.
They will attempt to dismantle our orderly society and replace it with something more controllable. They will act through human agents, she reminded us, using bribery, extortion, threats and murder to maneuver into a vulnerable position. And then they will strike, she said. Everyone at the table was quietly listening to her now. They are scandalized by some of our cultural differences from the Alka Alon and seek to exploit them. They understand the weaknesses in our food production and will seek to undermine them to cause famine. They appreciate, far more than Sherul, the nature of the human spirit and will try to subvert it through fear, misery and desperation. They will attack our weak points and bypass our strong points, assassinate our leaders and replace them with their puppets, feint at us with one attack while they bring the dagger to our heart with another. They are insidious, she pronounced, and they are absolutely certain not only of their inevitable victory, but of their eternal superiority.
Well, that should be easy to counter, then, Rostello muttered sarcastically, earning a laugh from the table.
What details did you learn of their plans, my lady? I asked gently. She seemed to have picked up more than I'd given her credit for. The Nemovorti have weaknesses, she decided, both individually and collectively. Not every assumption of a new host body is entirely successful, she added. I heard whispers that sometimes the original host mind lingers and seeks to cast doubts onto every thought. A few were driven mad by it.
Well, that's good to know, Telamon said seriously. What kinds of personal weaknesses, he asked, taking another big drink.
Vanity, flattery, pride, ignorance, stupidity.
Surely a war mage has knowledge of these, she teased. I myself have been cursed with incredible humility, agreed Wenick sorrowfully.
The Nemovorti seem even more obsessed with these matters than men, Andra continued, and they fight amongst each other incessantly, all the while declaring absolute loyalty to Korbal. There is a kind of competition, she recalled. Each Nemovort will be responsible for destabilizing a different region. The ones who bring their region to conquest first will be rewarded with higher position in Korbal's court.
They think they're just going to be able to dance into the kingdom and slice it up between them, snorted Telamon.
You doubt their commitment, my lord Telamon?
Andra asked, doubtfully. I doubt their abilities, Telamon countered. I've faced them in battle, my lady. While individually powerful, he conceded, they don't understand how to work together to complement their efforts. It's like attempting an honest fight with a bunch of tournament monkeys, he quipped. Each one thinks he's doing himself when it comes to battle, but they're so full of their own ego that they can't effectively fight as a unit.
They can conspire as a unit, offered Landrick.
That can be just as effective. Depending upon what targets they select and how they decide to take them, they could easily conquer any number of poorly run domains.
They don't even have to conquer, corrected Sandoval. They just have to disrupt our society enough to give them an opportunity to attack it. I can think of a dozen ways to do that myself. Hells, we've done that to ourselves a dozen ways in my lifetime.
Do you think inflicting Prince Tavard on us was part of his evil plan? Wenick asked, with mock suspicion.
We owe them a raid just for that.
No, unfortunately, we have no one to blame for Tavard but Grendine, I observed. And Tavard, for that matter. I do hope he's having a lovely time conquering the lichen-covered rocks of southern and ultramar for the glory of the Castali people. I'd hate to see my tribute wasted on half-efforts, I said, shaking my head. Just normal bitching about the boss that everyone but the king gets to indulge in. But some divinity must have heard me.
About 10 minutes later, we were approached by a young girl about 10, bearing a baldric with an odd device, a spiny-looking thistle.
"Begging your pardon, Baron Menelin," she said in a Wilderland's brogue, after politely waiting for a break in the conversation to introduce herself, "but I was sent to inquire if you would be free to wait upon Princess Radin for a few brief moments of conversation this evening."
She added a darling little curtsy, Wilderland's style. "Princess Radin?" I asked, surprised. "I thought she was at Angwin's country estate."
"Her Highness chose to come to Verone for a few days to meet with her seamstresses and dressmakers," the little girl explained. "It was mere fortune that brought you to town at the same time. She's staying at Yeza House as a guest of Lady Loreth. I can take you there now," she said, in a tone that told me she wasn't impressed by my title.
I decided not to resist. Telemann was telling the same story for the third time. Wenick was falling asleep, chin on his chest. Sandoval and Andrew were snuggling and squirming under his cloak. Rostallo and Landrick were eyeing the barmaids, and I had already had a long day.
"I must attend the princess, it seems," I announced to everyone to a few groans. I said my farewells and followed the little girl into the night. I had no idea what Radin wanted with me, but if she had some intelligence I could use, and that was likely, I wanted to know.
Chapter 60. Radin's Revenge. My relationship with Princess Radin, of House Bimin, had never been particularly friendly. I could date my personal distaste for her to the day after the Battle of Timberwatch, when I found out she'd ordered the assassination of a duke and a duchess and tried to assassinate me. We'd had a complicated relationship since then. I was, therefore, at least somewhat justified in the feeling of anxiety that came over me briefly as I mounted the ornate stairs up to the magnificent doorway of Yeza House. But the young woman who met me that evening was much different than the arrogant girl who'd ordered my valet to stab me in the back. Age, and her ordeal, had contributed to her maturity, I could see. And she wasn't even snide, as she invited me into her chamber with two ladies of the court. That alone told me at once that she'd transformed.
"Baron Menelin," she said formally, as she led me to a comfortable chair. "Thank you for taking the time to see me at such an inconvenient hour."
"I was carousing with old war comrades," I shrugged, "and a wizard keeps his own hours." It was my pleasure to respond. "What can I do for you this fine evening, Your Highness?" I asked, nodding to the other two women, one of which I recognized at once.
"Is she?" "Excellency, this is Baroness Amandis and Viscountess Thrianus of my cousin's court. They have been advising me since I came to Verone in the options available to me," she said quietly, as she took a seat on a divan.
"Options, Highness?" I asked innocently, as I stared at Baroness Amandis. Of course, she had to be involved.
"As you know, I am estranged of my parents in the face of their reluctance to commit to certain policies," she said, a twinkle in her eye.
That was her way of letting me know she was still livid with Rad and Grendine over letting her languish in Olam Seheri. "Politics is oft a strain on families," I nodded simply. "No need to make any enemies prematurely."
"In this case, it has interrupted a search for, well, for a suitable match," she said, a trace of the arrogant girl returning. "As you may have heard, I have encountered challenges finding a husband who is of suitable position and stature, as well as one I find compatible. My recent tour was to present me to suitors, though it felt more like an auction," she confessed bitterly. "After finding no suitable prospects in Faerice, which was not unexpected, my father was considering approaching a Count in Vore to consider my hand." She gave me a determined look. "In fucking Vore, Menelin," she said, her voice dripping with contempt. "That's not even in the kingdom." "That was by device," assured Viscountess Thrianus, a smug smirk on her thin lips. "It is well known at court that the princess, the other princess, wants Radin as far away from the royal court as possible, and the Castali ducal court," she added. "If she can't force Radin into a convent, then marriage to an aging aristocrat on the other end of the world is acceptable to her royal highness." "That will not do at all,"
Baroness Amandis, better known as Lady Pleasure, or, more precisely, Ishi,
goddess of love and beauty, declared.
Not for a princess, the first princess of Castelshar.
I empathize, Your Highness. I nodded cautiously, but I failed to see how I can help. I have a wife, I said, ensuring that she took it as a joke and not an honest proposal. Women are funny that way.
When I discussed the possible course of action with my new friends, Radin continued, fidgeting slightly, the Baroness insisted we contact you, and that she knew you were but blocks away this evening.
Damn Sandoval and Andra, the smouldering passionate told Ishii where I was. Is there someone you want me to charm, then, Your Highness?
Nearly, she nodded. Not magically. Indeed, right now I have more need of your wise counsel than your spellcraft. No, my friends wish to hear your opinion on a possibility I proposed.
She paused, as if steeling herself.
I am thinking of wedding Anguin.
I think Ishii wanted me there just to see the look on my face. She stifled a giggle. Now, that, I said slowly, taking my pipe out, is an interesting idea.
The political advantage to both parties would be significant,
Viscountess Triana's suggested.
Duke Anguin would get a bride of his station and position, as well as take a suitable dowry,
she pointed out. For such ducal weddings, I knew, the dowry tended to be in the form of entire domains and baronies.
I have it on authority that His Grace finds Her Highness a pleasant and engaging companion of sharp wit and elegant taste.
Does he now? I asked, glancing at Ishii.
More? It would aid in legitimizing his position as duke, and make it much more difficult for King Rad to repudiate him in favor of a rival claimant to the coronet, regardless of how much of Alshar he might control.
I hadn't considered that. If Rad made common cause with the Count of Reims, and recognized his claim to Alshar in return for his fealty, that could see Anguin out of his inheritance. A marriage to Rardine made that a lot less likely. One does not disinherit one's son-in-law, not if your daughter is an assassin by training.
There's one additional benefit for Alshar and Anguin,
Rardine pointed out.
He gets someone who knows every detail of Mother's network, including who her secret spies are here in Verone. I will volunteer to take over the intelligence operations for the court, she declared.
And then there was that.
So what do you get out of it, Your Highness? I asked. I get security, Radin answered. Security and a political base from which to operate. One closer than Vor, she added with a sneer. That means more to me than anything right now. Believe it or not, Baron, it was actually more difficult to discover that I was, for all purposes, exiled from my own court when I returned than it was to hear the simpering excuses about why no one was sent to deliver me.
I can appreciate that, I said truthfully. But there are issues with your proposal, I said, taking a deep breath.
Consanguinity? Viscountess Thryanus asked. His Grace and Her Highness are first cousins. Such unions have been permitted in the past, with sufficient clerical attention.
It could be used as a means of blocking a wedding, agreed Ishii, but is it really the only leverage they have against the idea?
Radin is old enough to make her own decision now.
They could apply considerable social pressure, I pointed out. If the king and queen raised a fuss, they could make it almost impossible, or attempt to change your mind.
I find myself strangely unwilling to be persuaded, Radin said evenly. I learned a lot about commitment in that cell.
Let's assume that you do somehow convince your parents to bless the union, I proposed. Is there not still the problem of, I said, trailing off as I stared at Radin.
Speak plainly, my lord,
Radin said, her eyes narrowing.
Well, it is widely suspected that Grendine was behind the assassination that gave the orphan duke his name, I pointed out.
Thryanus stiffened. Ishii leaned forward in anticipation of the drama. Radin sighed.
I have confessed my part in that plot to Anguin in private, and begged his forgiveness. He has been very good to me, much better than I deserve, she confessed. While he is still angry about it, he doesn't blame me personally, she stressed.
If he's deceiving you, it will likely be a short honeymoon, I suggested, as diplomatically as I could.
I've already given Angwin the opportunity to strike me dead, Radin said softly. I put the naked sword in his hand. I heard what he did to the regent here. Yeah. I threw myself on his mercy, and he granted me grace.
That was surprising. I never thought she'd have the humility or empathy to make such a dramatic display. Nor was I entirely confident that Angwin would restrain himself at such an opportunity. A more religious man might consider it a gift from the gods. I glanced at Ishii before I continued. Would this be viewed favorably in court? I asked, looking at Thrianus. She nodded, reluctantly.
Angwin is in almost as difficult a position as Radin, she pointed out. He could enter into an unproductive alliance with Rhymir by marrying one of Clefallon's many nieces, or he could marry into the lesser nobility of Castal. Either course of action presents difficulties and opportunities lost. Whereas, if Angwin marries Radin, he not only marries into a ducal house, he marries into the royal house, effectively putting him in the line of succession should, the gods forbid, anything should happen to Tavard while he's abroad.
There is still the heir and his mother, I pointed out.
Exactly, Radin said, her eyes narrowing. By marrying Angwin, I become a legitimate threat to Amandra and her brat. Not a vague, indistinct, in-the-background threat, but a real and constant factor in every decision she makes for the rest of her anxious life. Usually a young woman seeks passion and strength in marriage. Radin was seeking revenge. I sighed.
I feel I should at least ask, do you bear even a modicum of actual, authentic love for the lad?
That's a bold question, Darren,
Thrianus reproved, her wrinkled brow furrowing. If I am to give honest counsel, I need candid information, I reasoned. I would not support a union if it was based entirely on political considerations, I said. That would be an affront to Trigg and Ishii, I added, glancing at the Baroness.
I do love him a little, she confessed, after some thought. Enough. He is kind and brave, determined and intelligent, respectful and commanding, she concluded. All those weeks in that cell, I prayed to the gods to send me a deliverer. They could have sent anyone. They chose him, and he chose to risk his coronet, his future, and the lives of brave men to come and get me. That, Baron Minolin, is more than enough to base love upon, she said proudly.
And what kind of wife would you make him? I asked, curious.
Again, Baron, scolded Thrianus. Bide, Viscountess,
Radin pleaded quietly.
As he said, he needs candid information, and he is not wrong to ask. He has seen me at my worst, she said guiltily, in the depths of my entitlement, risen in position on the corpses of others. Too many others. But it is a fair question, she continued, staring at me. One any man wishes to know about a friend's prospective bride, and Duke Angwin does count you his friend, she affirmed. To answer? I know not, spellmonger. I saw every shred of dignity and pride stripped from me in that cell, and swore I would do anything to get out. Considering how bloody my past was, that entailed quite a bit, she added with dark humour. Now, by Trigg's grace, I find myself free once again, free, secure, and at liberty, in answer to my fervent prayers. And it gives me pause for thought, she said contemplatively. If I was willing to commit vile murder and base betrayal to gain my freedom, what if the cost was, instead, humility, humanity? When all that I held dear and worked so hard for was not just taken from me, but used against me? What if the price of my redemption was decency?
That's not oft a characteristic of a good intelligence head, I pointed out skeptically.
Nor am I pious enough to believe in conversions of character, she agreed. I said I had a change of heart. I didn't say I was struck with stupidity. I take no trouble in doing the unfortunate, indecent things that sometimes need to be done, as long as it is in service to Angwin, who is decent. If it takes my wedding vow for him to entrust me with that responsibility, I am ready. And if the price of my freedom is a lifetime of marriage to a good man, I shall seek to pay it gladly and without resentment,
she continued. Trigg knows I would have done far worse things to escape Olam Saheri. Why not marry and give my support and my skills into the hands of a man I respect?
Respect enough to bear his children?
Ishi asked expectantly, because she has an inherently dirty mind.
Of course,
Radin dismissed. A woman finds her legacy in her children the way a man does in his work or his lands. I would bear him an army of heirs, she said proudly.
And fidelity?
Ishi prompted.
My lady, you are newly acquainted of me personally, so I forgive the implication. But if I plight my troth with Anguin, I will faithfully see it fulfilled. I have seen enough of courtiers' dalliances to know what a distraction and erosion of faith they can be.
I think that disappointed Ishi, from what I could read on her face. I knew Radin well enough to know that promiscuity wasn't among her vices. Still, I couldn't help but wonder what deeper game she was playing. Radin was perhaps the most intelligent of the royal family, and while she shared her mother's ruthless ambition, it seemed tempered by her father's sense of statecraft. I took her at her word, but I strongly suspected there were further plots in that twisted mind of hers. I took a deep breath. If that is the case, and I confirm this with Anguin, then you have my support, as well as my counsel. I certainly have no objections, though I confess I still harbor the tiniest feeling concerning our encounter at Timberwatch, I reminded her. She shrugged.
I am sorry.
That was Mother's order, by the way, just as she ordered Isili to do what she did. I was more concerned with the political situation in the army, actually. Two captains and an ancient died mysteriously after Timberwatch, agents of Rhaemir and Merwin.
You tried to kill me with my own manservant, I pointed out dryly.
Would you rather I had Isili do it? At the time, you were quite fond of her, and she of you,
she added knowingly.
Yet it was her loyalty to your command that compelled her to gain leverage on me, I said, thinking of the first daughter Isili bore from me in secret. That had been on Radin's command. The second was due purely to Isili's madness and obsession with me.
She was perfectly normal, until you gave her that witch stone,
Radin pointed out. After she left our service and began an affair with Dunsellin.
Dunsellin, of all people,
she snorted in disgust. After that, she was her own creature.
I so swear.
I didn't really doubt it. Isili had used her freedom from the family gainfully, and the power she gained in Irionite soon fueled her obsession for arcane power. That obsession had led to her constructing the Green Flower Array and maiming my wife. I was still a little resentful about that. I will begin working on this at once, I promised them as I rose. The consanguinity issue is the most serious and pressing, I think. I will work on that. But you have my support, Highness. Provided you do not betray my friend Anguin, that would lose my support.
If I can make myself accountable to the gods, I think I can manage to do so to you, Baron. Thank you for your time and your counsel, she smiled. I think perhaps this is the beginning of a great alliance.
I'd settle for an end to worrying about breathing when she was around, I decided. I left the townhouse and walked down the steps into the night, because I've always thought it rude to depart someone else's home magically. That doesn't mean I haven't done it, of course. Sometimes being rude is just a tool in a wizard's bag. But the night was still clear, and it was but an hour past midnight, according to the sound of the bells from the temple ward. Most of the lights in the city were out now, and there were few wandering the streets this far away from the illicit districts, save the city watch. For some reason, I didn't want to leave just yet, and when my nose caught a familiar whiff of smoke and ash, I realized why. I decided I wanted to take a stroll through town to the site of the former palace. It was hard to believe it had been almost a year since Shirul sent a dragon to share his feelings about some raids into the penumbra by destroying the grand old place. Unfortunately for him, he'd done it while most of the war magi in the Wilderlands were gathered for a clandestine conference. So we were able to slay it, after much difficulty. Hundreds of people had lost their lives, and countless treasures and legacies of House Tyrene were consumed by the flame. It had taken weeks to contend with the damage, recover the dead, and restore order following the attack, and the entire time, I recalled, that smell hung in the air over Varone like a pall. The dragon was gone now, painstakingly hacked up and moved to Pentandra's estate just outside of town, where it was being transformed into tough armor for war magi and valuable lore for thaumaturges. The ruins of the palace, likewise, were gone. At great expense and over the course of months, wains and hocksters had been filled with debris from the place and removed from the site, until all that remained was a cleared site and a single large pile of stone and bricks Carmella's builders had chosen to be reused in the new castle. But that smell was still lingering in the air like the memory of a tasteless joke. I found myself walking toward the old palace just to enjoy the peace of the night in a pretty place like Varone. Thankfully, the destruction had largely been confined to the palace grounds, leaving the narrow streets of homes, flats, and shops nearby mostly undamaged. Outside of the missing palace, most of Varone seemed intact a year after the attack. In some ways, I reflected, the attack indicated a turning point in Anguin's rule. Losing the palace was devastating, but it also freed the lad from generations of tradition and rules that no longer applied to the administration of his current lands. It had also decentralized power, forcing most of his court ministers to govern from their nearby estates or rented halls. While that might have diminished a noble's power in many circumstances, Anguin, and Count Angriol, I had to admit, had turned the temporary inconvenience into an advantage. Each ministry was commanded to restructure and restaff itself based on the Rump Duchy's current needs, not the legacies of past policies. That got rid of a lot of dead weight, Pentandra had informed me, and allowed for a much nimbler administration. As I entered the broad, mostly empty stretch where the palace had been, I was able to see the progress on the new citadel that was to replace it, growing resolutely at the far end of the lot. In less than a year, using magic, Carmella and her crews had managed to lay the foundations, excavate the underground portions, and lay out the basic shape of the castle. One side, I saw, was already starting to sprout from the ground. Long lines of mage-cut stone blocks snaked across the top of the heavy foundation stones, melded into place with bricking ones. Scaffolds were already being built to carry the work higher, I was pleased to see. Usually it took years to get a castle to this point, I reflected, as I walked across the site. Traditional construction techniques, not to mention the inefficient methods of rounding up work corvées and getting them to work with skilled masons, meant that it could take as much as 20 or 30 years to complete even a small castle. Something this large would usually take generations to build. Magic changed all of that. Magic and military-style organization. While the site was empty at this hour, I could see a dozen or more neat and tidy stations where various projects were being worked upon. Stakes and string crisscrossed the area, I saw as I got closer. I stopped and sat on a pile of bricks to think and smoke for a moment, while I contemplated what the castle would eventually look like. I'd been there for perhaps 10 minutes when I heard a sound behind me. I wasn't concerned with footpads, despite Varone's recent reputation. The man who attempts to rob the spellmonger is in for a nasty surprise. But no demand for money or threats against my life was forthcoming. My visitor was a girl of maybe 16 or 17, hard to say in the darkness.
"You looking for company tonight to keep you warm, my lord?"
she asked in a saucy Wilderlands brogue. A prostitute, I realized. "I am warm enough," I said apologetically, "though I wouldn't mind some company if you'd like to sit," I decided.
"Don't usually get paid for sitting," she quipped with a sigh.
She dropped some of her professional act and took a seat beside me on the pile.
"Kneeling? Yeah, just as well," she decided. "I had 6 clients tonight, thanks to the soldiers starting to come back to town. Wasn't really game for a 7th, but a girl has to make a living," she decided. "I'm Maid Cluaren," she said, introducing herself, though the use of the term maid seemed ironic.
"Minilyn," I nodded, exhaling smoke. I didn't bother adding a title or descriptors. I could tell she knew the name at once.
"Minilyn? Like that wizard fellow?" she asked, startled.
"Just like that wizard fellow," I agreed, "only better looking in person. I'm the spellmonger, Maid Cluaren. Just popping in for a chat with the princess, a few drinks with comrades, and a pipe to think with, before I return home to the Riverlands.
Tonight?
She asked skeptically. Ain't it a bit late to be on the road? I chuckled. I use magic to travel that great a distance, Cloarin. Moments after I depart, I will be 1,000 miles away, safe in my own bed in the distant Riverlands.
Well, ain't that a spell?
She asked, laughing sweetly. Save a lot on shoe leather, I imagine.
So, you really slayed that dragon?
She asked. Slew, I corrected, and yes, I helped. My friend Sir Tyndall did the hard part, I conceded.
Sir Haystack? I'd heard that, but none of the girls believed it. He seems too young and fair to be that good a warrior.
You know the man.
Only by reputation,
she offered.
He ain't had me yet, but all the girls think he's handsome. Almost as handsome as our lad the Duke. I'm more partial to Sir Straker, though,
she confided.
He never had me neither, but I like the quiet ones. More of a challenge to make them holler.
Your dedication to professional excellence is admirable, I said, chuckling to myself. I wondered what the lads would say about this young whore's assessment. Do you work for one of the houses in the Street of Perfume?
Oh, I did a spell at the House of Flowers, she admitted. But, well, it was weird,
she said thoughtfully.
After all the fuss last Ishi's Day, a couple of the girls and I moved out and set up on our own. We had a flat a few streets back, but then Delra got pregnant and married a commando, and Rishi decided to take holy orders, so just it lulled Cloarin to make the rent, she said proudly.
Are times good? I asked thoughtfully. I wasn't aware of any lord or magic that made the opinions of whores an accurate economic survey, but I could make some astute guesses.
6 in one night, and it not even a market day, Cloarin asked, amused.
I recall a few years ago when a lass had to beg for a man to spend 2 coppers on her company. Now I get a silver penny per hour by the temple bells, she said proudly. With so many of the other girls off getting wed to soldiers, there's plenty of demand, she assured me. Even with the palace gone. A tumble with a mason isn't as lucrative or clean as one with a courtier, she considered, but they tend to be more fulfilling and just as lucrative, she added, jingling her purse. They don't like to sport as much either, so it gives a girl more time to work. Just in, out, and pay me, please, she laughed.
And if they don't pay?
Oh, that don't happen no more, she assured. Even those girls who don't have a house on the street don't worry about it. A man who refuses to pay can be charged with rape, if he's not careful. That's a headsman's offence in Verone, she said solemnly. But it don't usually get like that. Usually a man comes up with the coin after a simple beating. I got a couple of stout lads I can call on at need. Treat a man to ham soaking in front of his wife and children over a whore, he learns to pay his debts.
That sounded more like the Wilderland's justice I was familiar with, casual and thorough. I've never had a case of an unpaid whore in my docket, I realized with a laugh.
What? Ain't you got whores in
Sevendor? I supplied. That's my barony. That impressed her.
You're a baron. A wizard who's a baron. Well, ain't that a sight?
We don't have many whores in Sevendor, I answered her. Not permanent professionals, in any case. Many a wife and maid will misplace their virtue for a few days at the fair in the autumn, but most of the local girls marry early, and then keep their husbands too preoccupied to dally.
They just think they do, she snorted skeptically. I ain't met a man yet who wasn't ready for a tumble if he had coin in his purse and the girl was pretty enough, she reflected. Don't think I'd like Sevendor, though.
Those Riverland lads talk funny, she complained. Oh, there are plenty of Wilderland's boys in Sevendor, I informed her. I settled 4,000 refugees from the Mindons there. And in Sevendor, the maids complain about how they are the ones who talk funny.
Well, maybe I'll come visit, perchance, she decided. Truth is, wizard, I like my work, but I'm starting to get bored.
Most girls in your situation consider marriage as an alternative, I pointed out.
Oh, I had a couple of offers, she agreed, but not the right ones. I ain't ready to settle down to a kitchen yet, and when I do, it will be with a proper man, not some infantryman or stone cutter, she predicted. I ain't a lady, but you blow out the candle and come to bed, I can make you think I'm one, she said, lapsing back into her professional sales pitch. She paused to think for a moment. Mayhap I'll come to your seven door, by your leave, and take a look around.
It's safer than Verone, I pointed out. Less goblins, at least, and less footpads.
Oh, none of them lads will bother us girls, she assured. They know better. They start a ruckus with us, and the night elves come for 'em.
I pulled a coin out of my purse, a golden rose, damn it, and handed it to her. This will get you there if you're interested. She looked surprised.
You're giving me coin. You want to?
No, no, I chuckled, though you're a comely girl and lively, as I like them. I have a wife.
You think all my clients are single men?
She asked wryly. No, of course not, but my wife has been ill. I miss her terribly, I realized, as a wave of unexpected misery washed over me. Sometimes I was so desperate for the sound of her voice, the touch of her hand, that I could feel physical pain.
Oh, you poor duck,
she clucked sympathetically.
I got a regular in that position, she informed me, a weaver. His wife fell down the stairs a few years ago. Now she can't walk good. He has me come by once a week for a pick-me-up. Nice man, she decided. She took the coin. Maybe I will go to your barony, wizard. Sounds like a nice place.
It is, I agreed. It really is. I worked very hard to make it that way. But in Sevendor, magic is around every corner, I told her. Wizards walk the streets as thick as day laborers. At night, mage lights spring up all over the town, and the fountains run, day and night, thanks to magic.
Well, isn't that a wonder?
She said, thinking about my description.
I might like to see that.
If the war don't interrupt, she added anxiously. Best you find a coach headed east soon, then, love, I sighed, looking anxiously at Angwin's unfinished castle, because that could happen at any moment. Part 4. Love and Marriage. Interlude 5. Desviatus. The Ageless Company. The hull of the two-masted Cormyran galleon named Aspethel groaned as the master of the vessel, Captain Desviatus, changed course and brought her abreast of the increasingly turbulent waves as the sun went down. The course correction would soon take them out of sight of the rest of the Castali fleet that had departed for Ys, though they wouldn't be alone. Three other ships had quietly done the same as soon as the sun had set by prearranged signal. It was a dangerous move in a dangerous moment. The fleet admiral had sent explicit orders about maintaining fleet formation before they'd departed for Ys. Most of them covered the massive armada of pirates, slavers and renegades, waiting to pounce on wayward Castali ships, but the last few promised severe retributions for any considering deserting the force before they arrived north in an ultramar. But things happened at sea, at night, particularly during the kind of storm that was brewing out of the northeast. The Cormyran master of the Aspethel was intimate with these waters, having plied the eastern shallow sea his entire life in pursuit of his trade. There was bound to be variations in speed among the widely varied ships of the Slapdash fleet. Most of the ships were low-drafted caravels, the kind that plied the routes betwixt Remir, Castol, and Cormyr. They were ill-suited for deeper waters, though serviceable in other ways. A few were much deeper-drafted galleons, like the Aspethel, with three or even four masts, predominantly from Cormyr. Other parts of the fleet had been patched together from independent, landless mercenaries. Sea knights, seeking adventure on their families' merchantmen, a contingent of decrepit Vorian cogs looking for a billet, fleeing from creditors in their home duchy, and a single Merwini brigadine, captained by a Remiran master. That was in addition to the ducal fleet, the dozen-odd Castali carracks that weren't good for much of anything beyond hauling horses and provisions for the expedition. And then there was the Farisi contingent. The score of coastal defence loops were the basis of harbour defence for the strategic port, a robust little fleet specifically designed for the protection of the vulnerable harbour. Commanded from one of a pair of caravels and flagged with the colours of the Royal Admiralty, the shallow-drafted ships were ideal for nimbly tacking to intercept raiders, smugglers, or pirates who might challenge Castal Shah's possessions of the peninsula. Once intercepted, the broad forecastles of the sloops, filled with crossbowmen and boarding marines, could quickly overcome all but the largest ships.
but those were local ships, designed for shallow water and with no room for provision. The two caravels were heavily armed, but similarly unprepared for extended voyages. Yet that nautical common sense meant nothing to Prince Tavard, when he'd boldly insisted on adding the ships to his expeditionary fleet under his father's presumed authority. After the regent of the possession objected, Tavard relented a single caravel and a brace of sloops to remain behind, but he insisted on taking an additional 200 archers from the city's garrison to make up for it, he said. The additional ships dragged the rest of the fleet to a crawl. Nor would they fare well in the storm ahead, Desviatus reasoned. Should they survive and come to face the Al-Shari armada in battle, the sloops would break in the face of real warships, the infamous Al-Shari corsairs, the bronze-clad barks used by the sea lords to raid and pillage, the self-exiled Farisi merchant fleet, and the various ships used by the pirate gangs and slavers who had confederated with the Al-Shari this season. Those sloops would sink or be taken quickly, their men in irons and sold at auction. He favoured the Absathel's chances better. The galleon was arrayed for war, the forecastle bristling with weaponry and her sails cut to a military bearing. Her crew was doughty, veterans of many a scrape. Most were descended from the same ratty village seaport in Cormyr and gone to sea early, just as had generations of their forebears. He could trust them in ways he could not trust a hired crew, and within the holds of the galleon were 200 men who knew how to fight. But Captain Desviatus did not favour the chances the fleet as a whole bore against the Al-Shari. It was too fractured and ill-prepared for what awaited them. Desviatus knew in his heart of hearts that most of the men who took wave from Faris were doomed. Desviatus also knew he would not be one of them. He tracked the ship's location by the stars until the clouds rolled in near midnight. When he was satisfied, just as the rains from the storm began to fall, he called his mate and issued orders to douse the lights, lower the colours, and re-rig the sails, with the ones he'd had to replace after their last encounter with an Eastern Island rover off Merwin's coast. The denim fabric was burnt and torn from the missiles and attacks of the cunning Easterners, and bore all authentic signs of battle. The flag he directed the mate to raise after the Castelshari colours were struck were in stark contrast to the naval ensign. They were black, bearing in white a charge of two ovals joined by a line, a chain, more precisely, a slave merchant's token. Desviatus was fortunate to be served by such loyal men. A mercenary crew might have blanched at flying that standard. Slaving was disreputable but profitable work that no honest mariner wanted a part in. Far too many of their fellows had been taken by such ships and ended their lives in chains themselves. But his crew trusted his judgment and wintered back home with coin in their purse because he knew the seas and knew the men who needed that knowledge. Things were not often what they seemed, he'd told them, and such rich men should have the taste not to ask too many questions. When he was satisfied that the rigging and colours were changed, he gave the mate a few more orders before descending the ladder to the hold of the ship. In that cramped space, 200 seasick wilderlords were riding out the storm that had only begun to toss the ship. Mercenaries, who'd hired on to Prince Tavard's expedition, the big men might be as brave and fierce as their reputation gave, but the shipwrecker cared not for a man's size, or his valour. All were equally puny in her eyes. "Is all well, Captain?" Sir Danver, the company's captain, asked. The man looked green in the gloom of the hold, but Desviatus doubted it would improve much by light of day. "Storm coming up," he grunted. "Might be a bad one. How fare you, wilderfolk?" "We'll survive with Duin's grace," he grunted, looking miserable. Duin was the wrong divinity to invoke, Desviatus considered telling him. He didn't bother. That was a landsman's affair. He looked at the man critically, then glanced back into the hold, just in time to see a small crowd around the sop bucket heaving. He sighed.
"By the maiden's grace, I'll spare a double ration of grog for every man," he decided. "It will soothe the nerves and help pass the night."
The last thing he needed was a hold full of panicky wilderlords, armed or not.
"It'll do your stomachs good, too, mixed with sugar and lime."
"I'd very much appreciate it," Sir Danver assured him. He had the mate see to the dispensing personally, witnessing every man in turn get his two-handled cup filled and drank. No more, no less. When he'd had the mate administer special herbs to a few particularly affected wilderlords, he retired back to his cabin to review the charts by lamplight. The intensity of the storm was increasing, he could feel, but he'd managed to steer the fragment of the fleet along its southern edge, avoiding the brunt of it that would be thrashing the rest of the Castali-flagged ships. After an hour's worth of lamp oil had burned, he returned below decks to see to his passengers, taking the mate and the bosun with him. The light from his lamp shone on the unconscious bodies of 200 able-bodied wilderlords. Desviatus nodded in satisfaction, then opened the lock to a sealed cargo locker. Removing the sailcloth that filled the compartment, he revealed tightly stacked, hinged rings of heavy bronze. Each one had a thick ring brazened to it, as well as a badge, a sea axe, encircled by a chain surmounted by an hourglass. The device of the ageless companions, pirates and smugglers of some repute. The Internation Brotherhood had existed for 5 centuries, both at sea and ashore, never growing too large and never attracting attention they didn't desire. Desviatus's fishing village in Cormyr had been the home to one clandestine port of the Companions, and after he'd spent a year at sea as a novice mariner, he'd been inducted into the Ageless Companions by his elder brothers and uncles. He learned the true art of maritime trade, moving the cargoes in highest demand past the most oppressive regulators for the highest possible profits. He'd learned the series of elaborate codes and ciphers the Companions used to conceal their communications. He'd learned of the secret alliances between the smugglers and a number of unlikely institutions across all 5 duchies, Farice, and beyond. Portmasters, merchant houses, taverners, custom clerks, inland lords, temples, Calrom tinkers, beggar kings, cults, tribal chiefs, slavers, local smugglers, pirates, landborne criminal organizations, thieves of repute, and even high nobles and ministers of state. Each had a role in the elaborate ecosystem of international smuggling. Most did not even suspect they were in fact dealing with smugglers in their business. Every ship of the Companions' fleet had many names, and the Brotherhood had agents in most ports. He'd learned the value of leaving port flying one flag and entering port flying another, of having multiple copies of the manifest in multiple languages, of building ships with concealed compartments, of passing coin from one hand to another without being seen, hiding serious business in light conversation. That was the beauty of the Ageless Companions. No one ever acknowledged being a member to a non-member. They were all just common merchants doing business with the mysterious organization, who seemed to have a wide range of business interests across the 5 duchies. But they were never to be found. Cargo they carried bearing its mark was always recently acquired from the enigmatic organization's shadowy agents. Deals they made were always alleged to be with faceless figures who were invariably referred to as Master Sensidat, an ancient Cormyran word for ageless. Negotiations were always allegedly held in taverns or brothels of low repute, arranged through disinterested third parties who could never quite recall the circumstances under a magistrate's examination. In the rare instances where the Companions needed to enforce their arrangements, they usually contracted out the distasteful duties to local thugs, professional mercenaries, or even nobles, if they could. The only time the Companions